35. We work in the dark, we do what we can, we give what we have. Our doubt is our passion, and our passion is our task. The rest is the madness of art. Henry James. It was early in the morning, the first class of the day. The classroom was filled with light. I was summing up James. Last time, we talked about certain traits in James, how they appear in different characters and within different contexts. And today, I want to talk about the word courage, one that we bandy about a great deal these days in our own culture. There are different kinds of courage in James. Can you think of an example? Yes, Nasreen. Nasreen said, the most obvious example is Daisy. She pushed herself forward with an effort, tried to brush an imaginary strand of hair from her forehead, and continued. Daisy tells Winterbourne at the very start not to be afraid. She means not to be afraid of conventions and traditions. That is one kind of courage. Yes, I said encouragingly, Daisy is a good example. And then there are other characters, others whom we never credit with courage because we never think of their kind as courageous. We think of them as meek. Mahshid's face lit up, and before she had bolstered the courage to raise her hand, I turned to her and said, "Yes?" The light withdrew from her face, and she hesitated. "Tell us, Mahshid," I insisted. "Well," she said, "when you said meek, I suddenly thought of Catherine. She's shy and retreating, not like Daisy. Yet she stands up to all these characters who are much more outgoing than her, and she faces up to them at a great cost. She has a different kind of courage from Daisy, but it is still courage. It was at this point that we heard a commotion in the hall. I paid no attention to it. Over the years, I had come to see such interference from outside the class as part of the class itself. One day, two janitors had walked in with two chairs and placed them in one corner. They left without a word, and a few minutes later came back with two more chairs. Another time, a janitor with a crooked neck came in with a broom and started sweeping the floor while I continued to talk about Tom Jones and pretended not to notice him. And then there is the ambassadors, I continued, where we find several different kinds of courage, but the most courageous characters here are those with imagination. Those who, through their imaginative faculty, can empathize with others. When you lack this kind of courage, you remain ignorant of others' feelings and needs. Maria, the soulmate Strether finds in Paris, has courage, while Mrs. Newsome has only exaltation. Madame de Vionnet, the beautiful Parisian, whom Mrs. Newsome is determined to expel from her son's life, demonstrates courage when she risks all the known quantities of her life for the unknown quantity of her love for Chad. But Mrs. Newsome chooses to play it safe. Having imagined what everyone is like, having imagined their function and role, she refuses to change her formulations. She's a tyrant, much in the way of a bad novelist, who shapes his characters according to his own ideology or desires and never allows them the space to become themselves. It takes courage to die for a cause, but also to live for one. I could tell by the restless movements of my students and their glances towards the door that they could not wholly concentrate on this most intriguing point. But I was determined to be undisturbed for as long as possible. So I continued. The most dictatorial character in the novel is the invisible Mrs. Newsome. If we want to learn about the essence of a dictatorial mind, we would do well to study her. Nima, could you please read the passage where Strether describes her, beginning with, "That is just her difficulty"? Nima read, "That is just her difficulty, that she doesn't admit surprises. It is a fact that I think describes and represents her. She's all, as I've called it, fine, cold thought. She had, to her own mind, worked the whole thing out in advance and worked it out for me as well as for herself. Wherever she's done that, you see, there is no room left, no margin, as it were, for any alteration. She's filled as full, packed as tight, as she'll hold. I haven't touched her. She won't be touched. I see it now as I've never done, and she hangs together with a perfection of her own. That does suggest a kind of wrong in any change of her composition." By this time, the disturbance outside had grown louder. There were sounds of feet running and people shouting. Miss Ruhi and Miss Hatef were now visibly agitated and whispered loudly, casting significant glances at the door. I sent them outside to find out what was happening and tried to go on. Let us return to the quotation. I was instantly interrupted by Miss Ruhi and her breathless mate, who stood on the threshold as if they did not intend to stay. They reported that a student had set fire to himself in an empty classroom and had then started to run down the hall shouting revolutionary slogans. We all rushed out. From both sides of the long hall, students were running in the direction of the staircase. I found a place near the stairs, close to one of my colleagues. Three people were carrying a stretcher, trying to make their way through the crowd towards the stairs. From the way they were carrying the stretcher, their burden seemed light. On the stretcher, under a white sheet, I could make out a remarkably pink face, marked by patches of dark grey. A pair of black minstrel hands extended out motionless above the sheet, creating the impression that they were trying to avoid contact with the sheet at all costs. Two huge black eyes seemed to be attached to the face by invisible wires. They appeared completely motionless, as if fixed on a scene of unbelievable horror. And yet, paradoxically, they also seemed to be roving, but from side to side. Of all the wild images of that morning, those roaming eyes have continued to haunt me. The loudspeakers urged everyone to return to their classes. No one moved. We were watching the pink face, the minstrel hands, and the sooty eyes as they were carried down the staircase in what seemed like a spiral motion. The murmurs died down and rose again with the stretcher's approach and descent. It was one of those scenes which, while happening in front of one's eyes, have already acquired the quality not just of a dream, but of a memory of a dream. As the stretcher moved down the stairs and out of sight, the murmurs became more articulate and clear. The almost magical creature on the stretcher became more tangible, acquired a background, a name, an identity. This identity was mainly impersonal. He had been one of the most active students in the Muslim Students Association. To say that he was active meant that he was one of the more fanatical. He belonged to the group responsible for the posters and slogans on the walls, the group that had authorized the notices at the entrances to the university listing the names of those who had transgressed the dress code. I thought of him on that stretcher going down the staircase, passing the now irrelevant photographs of the war, passing by Ayatollah Khomeini, who even after death was glaring down on the procession with his usual stern and impenetrable gaze, and passing his precious slogans about the war. Whether we kill or are killed, we are victorious. We will fight, we will die, but we won't accept compromise. There were so many young men like him on all our campuses, those who had been very young at the beginning of the revolution, many from the provinces or from traditional families. Every year, more students were admitted to the universities based on their loyalty to the revolution. They belonged to the families of the revolutionary guards or the martyrs of the revolution and were called the government's share. These were the children of the revolution, those who were to carry its legacy and eventually replace the westernized workforce. The revolution must have meant many things to them, mainly power and access. But they were also the usurpers who had been admitted to the university and given power not because of their merit or hard work, but because of their ideological affiliations. This neither they nor we could forget. I went down the stairs, slowly this time, surrounded by a group of students who were talking excitedly among themselves. Who he was had already become an excuse for our remembrances and our stories. My students spoke heatedly about the humiliations they had suffered at the hands of members of his organization. They repeated the story of another leader of the Muslim Students Association, one who had died during the war, who claimed to have been sexually aroused by the sight of a white patch of skin peeking out from under a headscarf. Not even death could erase the memory of that white patch and the penalty the young girl had been made to pay for it. There were no public articulations of these humiliations, so we took refuge in accidental occasions to weave our resentments and hatreds into little stories that lost their impact as soon as they were told. Of the injured student's background, very little was known. No one seemed to care. It dawned on me only much later that despite the precision with which I remembered all the stories related to him and his comrades, I could not remember his name. He had turned himself into a revolutionary, a martyr, and a war veteran, but not an individual. Did he ever fall in love? Did he ever desire to hold one of those girls whose throats under their black scarves blazed so white? Like many others at that university, I had climbed the stairs and walked the halls with resentment. Resentment had erased all ambiguity in our encounters with people like him. We had been polarized into us and them. It did not occur to me or to my students and colleagues as we shared stories and anecdotes that day, like conspirators delighting in the setback of a far more powerful adversary, that he, who seemingly wielded so much power, was in fact the one with the strongest urge to self-destruction. Had he, by burning himself, usurped our right to revenge? He who in life had been nothing to me, in death had become an obsession. All we ever found out about his personal life was that he came from a poor family and that his only close relative was a very old mother whom he supported. He had gone to the war as a volunteer. He had been shell-shocked and sent home early. Apparently, he never fully recovered. After peace with Iraq, he returned to the university. But the peace had created a sense of disillusionment. The excitement of the war was gone, and with that, many young revolutionaries had lost their power. This war has been a blessing for us. For us, it was a war that we never felt quite a part of. Yet for people like him, in a strange way, the war must have been a blessing. It gave them a sense of community and purpose and power. He lost all that as soon as he returned from the front. His privilege and power meant nothing to him now, and his fellow Islamic students had already moved on. What must have gone through his mind when he saw that his old comrades were more eager to watch the Oscar celebrations via forbidden satellite dishes than clips from the war? He could deal with us, but what could he do with a Mr. Forsati, who had become as unfamiliar and as baffling to him as characters in a novel by Henry James? I kept thinking of him coming early to the university with two full cans of gasoline, probably not searched because he was a privileged war veteran. I see him going into an empty classroom and pouring gasoline over his head. Next, he would have struck a match and slowly set fire to himself. Did he light himself just once or in several places? Then he ran down the hall and burst into his classroom shouting, "They betrayed us! They lied to us! Look at what they did to us!" And that was the last of his rhetoric. One did not have to agree with him or approve of him to understand his position. He had returned from a war where he belonged to a university he had never been a part of. No one wanted to hear his stories. Only his moment of death could spark interest. It was ironic that this man, whose life had been so determined by doctrinal certainty, would now gain so much complexity in death. He died that night. Did his comrades mourn him in private? Nothing was said about him. No commemoration, no flowers or speeches in a country where funerals and mourning were more magnificently produced than any other national art form. I, who prided myself on speaking out against the veil or other forms of harassment, also kept quiet. Apart from the murmurs, the only thing out of the ordinary about that day was that the loudspeakers for some reason kept announcing in the halls that classes would be held as usual that afternoon. We did have a class that afternoon. It did not go on as usual. Part 4. Austin. 1. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a Muslim man, regardless of his fortune, must be in want of a 9-year-old virgin wife. So declared Yossi in that special tone of hers, deadpan and mildly ironic, which on rare occasions, and this was one of them, bordered on the burlesque. Or is it a truth universally acknowledged, Mona shot back, that a Muslim man must be in want not just of one, but of many wives? She glanced at me conspiratorially, her black eyes brimming with humor, knowing she would draw a reaction. And like Mahshid, Mona had a way of secretly communicating with the few people she liked. Her chief means of contact were her eyes, which she focused or withdrew from you. We had developed a hidden code between us, and only when she felt offended, and she could easily be offended, would she lower and divert her gaze to one side, the playful inflections wiped from her words. It was one of those cold, grey, early December mornings when the overcast sky and the chill in the air seemed to promise snow. I had asked Bijan to light a fire before leaving for work, and it sparkled now with a soothing warmth. Cozy, a word too common for Yossi's usage, would be the right term for how we felt. All the necessary components were there. Misty windows, steaming mugs of coffee, a crackling fire, languorous cream puffs, thick wool sweaters, and the mingling smells of smoke, coffee, and oranges. Yossi was sprawled on the couch in her usual place between Mana and Azin, making me wonder again how such a tiny body could take up so much space. Azin's flirtatious laughter rang in the air, and even Mahshid bestowed upon us a hint of a smile. Nasreen had moved her chair near the fireplace, her restless hands tossing orange peels into the fire. It was a tribute to the degree of intimacy that had developed among us that we could easily shift from light banter to serious discussions of the novels. What we had with all the writers, but especially with Austen, was fun. Sometimes we even went wild. We became childish and teasing and just plain enjoyed ourselves. How could one read the opening sentence of Pride and Prejudice and not grasp that this was what Austen demanded of her readers? That morning, we were waiting for Sanaz. Mitra, her dimples making a temporary appearance, had informed the class that Sanaz wanted us to wait for her. She had a surprise. All our wildest speculations were met with a reticent smile. Only two things could have happened, Azin speculated. Another row with her brother, and she's finally decided to leave home and move in with her wonderful aunt. She raised her hand with a tinkling of gold and silver bangles. Or she's marrying her sweetheart. The sweetheart seems the more likely of the two, said Yossi, straightening herself up a little, judging by Mitra's expression. Mitra's dimples widened, but she refused to respond to our provocation. Looking at her, I thought of her own recent marriage to Hamid. Their furtive courtship must have taken place right under my unsuspecting nose. They had invited me to their wedding, but Mitra had never mentioned her relations with Hamid before then. Did you fall in love? I had asked Mitra anxiously, causing Mana to say, that boring question again. It was a joke among my friends and colleagues that I could never resist posing my obsessive question to married couples. Did you fall in love? I'd ask urgently and eagerly, provoking almost invariably an indulgent smile. Mitra blushed and said, well, yes, of course. But who's thinking about love these days? Said Arzine with mock chastity. Her hair was pulled back in a ponytail, and clusters of tiny turquoise beads trembled slightly on her ears as she turned her head. The Islamic Republic has taken us back to Jane Austen's times. God bless the arranged marriage. Nowadays, girls marry either because their families force them, or to get green cards, or to secure financial stability, or for sex. They marry for all kinds of reasons, but rarely for love. I looked at Mahshid, who, although quiet, seemed to be saying, here we go again. And, Azin continued, reaching for her mug, we're talking about educated girls, girls like us who have gone to college, who one might think would have higher ambitions. Not all of them, Mahshid said quietly, without looking at Azin. Many women are independent. Look at how many businesswomen we have, and there are women who have chosen to live alone. Yes, and you are one of them, I thought. A studious, working girl, still living with her parents at 32. But most don't have a choice, said Mana. And I think we are way behind Jane Austen's times. This was one of the few instances I can remember when Mana implicitly sided with Azin against Mahshid. My mother could choose whom she wanted to marry. I had less choice, and my younger sister has even less, she concluded gloomily. How about a temporary marriage? Said Nasreen, rearranging the orange peels on her plate like pieces of a puzzle. You seem to have forgotten our president's enlightened alternative. She was referring to an Islamic rule peculiar to Iran, according to which men could have 4 official wives and as many temporary wives as they wished. The logic behind this was that they had to satisfy their own needs when their wives were unavailable or unable to satisfy them. A man could enter into a contract for as short a period as 10 minutes or as long as 99 years. President Rafsanjani, then honored with the title of reformist, had proposed that young people should enter into temporary marriages. This angered both the reactionaries who felt it was a shrewd move on the president's part to curry favor with the young, and the progressives, who were equally skeptical of the president's motives and, in addition, found it insulting, especially to women. Some went so far as to call the temporary marriage a sanctified form of prostitution. I'm not in favor of the temporary marriage, said Mahshid, but men are weaker and do have more sexual needs. Besides, she added cautiously, it's the girl's choice. She isn't forced into it. The girl's choice, said Nasreen with evident disgust. You do have funny notions of choice. Mahshid, lowering her eyes, did not respond. Some men, even the most educated, Nasreen continued fiercely, think of this as progressive. I had to argue with a friend, a male friend, that the only way he could convince me this was progressive was if the law gave women the same rights as men. You want to know how open-minded these men are? I'm not talking about the religious guys. No, the secular ones, she said, tossing another orange peel into the fire. Just ask them about marriage. Talk about hypocrisy. It's true that neither my mom nor my aunts married for love, Yasi said, furrowing her brow. But all my uncles married for love. It's strange when you think about it. Where does that leave us? What sort of legacy, I mean? I suppose, she added, brightening up after a moment's reflection, that if Austen were in our shoes, she'd say, it's a truth universally acknowledged that a Muslim man, regardless of his fortune, must be in want of a 9-year-old virgin wife. And this was how we started our play on Austen's famous opening sentence, a temptation that almost every Austen reader must have felt at least once. Our merrymaking was interrupted by the sound of the bell. Mahshid, who was closest to the door, said, I'll get it. We heard the street door close, steps on the stairs, a pause. Mahshid opened the front door to sounds of greetings and laughter. Sanaz came in, smiling radiantly. She was holding a box of pastries. Why the pastries? I asked. It isn't your turn. Yes, But I have good news, she said mysteriously. Are you getting married? Yossi asked lazily from the depths of the couch. Let me sit down first, said Sanaz, taking off her long overcoat and woolen scarf. She tossed her head to one side with the proud ease of women with beautiful hair and pronounced, It's going to snow. Would she apologize for being late, I wondered, even on this occasion when she has such a good excuse and no one would blame her? I'm so sorry I'm late again, she said, with a disarming smile that showed no sign of repentance. You usurped my rights, said Azin. Being late is my specialty. Sanaz wanted to defer her news until the break. Our rule was that the personal narratives that were increasingly creeping into our Thursday session should not interfere with class. But in this case, even I was too excited to wait. It was all done very quickly, Sanaz explained, caving into our demands. Suddenly, out of the blue, he had called and asked her to marry him, said something about running out of time. He told her he had already talked to his parents, who had talked to her parents, without asking her first, I noticed in passing. They were delighted, and since he couldn't come to Iran because of the draft, perhaps she and her family could come to Turkey. Iranians didn't need a visa for Turkey, and the trip could be arranged quickly. She was dumbfounded. It was something she'd always expected, but somehow couldn't believe it was actually happening. Your fire is almost out, she said, interrupting herself. I'm really good with fires. Let me fix it. She added some logs to the languishing fire and poked at it with energy. A long flame leapt out and died just as quickly. At the start of the 20th century, the age of marriage in Iran, 9, according to Sharia laws, was changed to 13 and then later to 18. My mother had chosen whom she wanted to marry, and she had been one of the first 6 women elected to parliament in 1963. When I was growing up in the 1960s, there was little difference between my rights and the rights of women in Western democracies. But it was not the fashion then to think that our culture was not compatible with modern democracy, that there were Western and Islamic versions of democracy and human rights. We all wanted opportunities and freedom. That is why we supported revolutionary change. We were demanding more rights, not fewer. I married, on the eve of the revolution, a man I loved. At that time, Mahshid, Nasreen, Mana, and Azin were in their teens. Sanaz and Mitra were a few years younger, and Yasi was 2 years old. By the time my daughter was born, 5 years later, the laws had regressed to what they had been before my grandmother's time. The first law to be repealed months before the ratification of a new constitution was the Family Protection Law, which guaranteed women's rights at home and at work. The age of marriage was lowered to 9, 8.5 lunar years, we were told. Adultery and prostitution were to be punished by stoning to death, and women and their law were considered to have half the worth of men. Sharia law replaced the existing system of jurisprudence and became the norm. My youthful years had witnessed the rise of 2 women to the rank of cabinet minister. After the revolution, these same 2 women were sentenced to death for the sins of warring with God and spreading prostitution. One of them, the Minister for Women's Affairs, had been abroad at the time of the revolution and remained in exile, where she became a leading spokesperson for women's rights and human rights. The other, the Minister of Education and my former high school principal, was put in a sack and stoned or shot to death. These girls, my girls, would in time come to think of these women with reverence and hope. If we had women like this in the past, there was no reason why we couldn't have them in the future. Our society was far more advanced than its new rulers, and women, regardless of their religious and ideological beliefs, had come out onto the streets to protest the new laws. They had tasted power and were not about to give it up without a fight. It was then that the myth of Islamic feminism, a contradictory notion attempting to reconcile the concept of women's rights with the tenets of Islam, took root. It enabled the rulers to have their cake and eat it too. They could claim to be progressive and Islamic, while modern women were denounced as westernized, decadent, and disloyal. They needed us, modern men and women, to show them the way, but they also had to keep us in our place. What differentiated this revolution from the other totalitarian revolutions of the 20th century was that it came in the name of the past. This was both its strength and its weakness. We four generations of women, my grandmother, my mother, myself and my daughter, lived in the present but also in the past. We were experiencing two different time zones simultaneously. Interesting, I thought, how war and revolution have made us even more aware of our own personal ordeals, especially marriage, at the heart of which was the question of individual freedom, as Jane Austen had discovered two centuries before. She had discovered it, I reflected. But what about us, sitting in this room, in another country, at the end of another century? Sanaz's nervous laughter brought me out of my reverie. "I'm so scared," she said, her right hand going to her brow to push back an absent strand of hair. "Up until now," she said, "marrying him has been sort of a dream, something to think about when I was fighting with my brother. I never knew, I still don't know, how it will all work out in real life." Sanaz was worried about the trip to Turkey and what it would be like to see him again. "What if he doesn't like me?" she said. She did not ask, "What if I don't like him?" or "What if we don't get along?" Would her brother become more vicious and her mother more depressed? Would her mother, with her martyr's look, make Sanaz feel guilty as if she had failed her on purpose? These were serious questions for Sanaz. It was hard to tell if she was going to Turkey to please the others or because she was in love. This was my problem with Sanaz. One never knew what she really wanted. "After 6 years, God knows what he'll be like," said Nasreen, absent-mindedly rotating the coffee mug in her hands. I looked at her with some concern, as I almost always did when our talks turned to marriage and men. I couldn't help but wonder how she dealt with her buried memories. Did she compare herself with her friends who were free of such experiences? And were they free of such experiences? Sanaz glanced at Nasreen reproachfully. Did she really need to hear this now? At any rate, going to Turkey would be good for her, even if it didn't work out. At least she'd get him out of her system. "Do you love him?" I asked her, trying to ignore the girl's sardonic smiles. "You'll always be taking a risk when you decide to marry. But the question is, do you love him now?" "I loved him When I was very young, Sana said slowly, too excited to participate in their joke. I don't know anymore. I've always loved the idea of him, but he's been away for so long. He's had so many chances to meet other women. What chance have I had of meeting other men? My aunt says I don't have to say yes or no. She says if we want to find out how we really feel about each other, we should meet in Turkey alone. We should spend some time together without our family's interfering presence. What an unusually wise aunt, I said, unable to stop myself from breaking in like a referee. She's right, you know. Mahshid raised her eyes in my direction for a fraction of a second before lowering them again. Azin, quickly catching Mahshid's look, said, I agree with Dr. Nafisi. You'd be wise to try to live together for a while before making any decisions. Mahshid decided not to take the bait and remained demurely silent. Was it my imagination, or did she cast a reproachful glance in my direction as she lowered her eyes, fixing them once more on an imperceptible spot in the carpet? The first thing you should do to test your compatibility, said Nasreen, is dance with him. At first, we were puzzled by her statement, which seemed far-fetched, even for Nasreen. It took me a second before I grasped her meaning. But of course, she was referring to the Dear Jane Society we'd invented in my last year at Allameh. The idea for that society, defunct even before it started, had begun with a memorable dance. 2. I see it now as if through the large window of a house in the middle of an empty garden. I've pressed my face to the window, and here they come. 5 women, all in black robes and headscarves. As each passes by the window, I can begin to differentiate their faces. One is standing and watching the other 4. They are not graceful. They bump into one another and into the chairs. They are boisterous in a peculiarly subdued manner. In my graduate seminar that spring, I had compared the structure of Pride and Prejudice to an 18th century dance. After class, some of the girls had stayed behind to talk this over. They were confused by what I had meant. I thought it best to explain myself by going over the motions of the dance with them. Close your eyes and imagine the dance, I suggested. Imagine you're moving back and forth. It would help if you could imagine that the man standing opposite you was the incomparable Mr. Darcy. Or maybe not. Whoever is on your mind, imagine him. I heard a giggle from one of the girls. Suddenly hit by inspiration, I took Nasreen's reluctant hands and started to dance with her. 1, 2, and 1, 2. Then I asked the others to form a line, and pretty soon we were all dancing, our long black robes twirling as we bumped into one another and into the chairs. They stand opposite their partners. Give a slight bow, step forward, touch hands, and twirl. I say, now as you touch hands, look into each other's eyes. Okay, let's see how much of a conversation you can hold. Say something to each other. They can barely keep their faces straight. Mojgan says, the trouble is, we all want to be Elizabeth and Darcy. I don't mind being Jane, says Nasreen. I always wanted to be the most beautiful. We need a Mr. Collins. Come on, Mahshid. Won't you enjoy stepping on my toes? Mahshid demurs. I've never danced in my life, she says awkwardly. This is one dance you needn't to worry about, I said. In fact, as your professor, I command you to do it. As part of your homework, I added, and it was one of the rare times I actually enjoyed my authority. Forward, backwards, pause, turn, turn. You have to harmonize your steps with the rest in the set. That's the whole point. You're mainly concerned with yourself and your partner, but also with all the others. You can't be out of step with them. Well, yes, that's the difficult part, but for Miss Eliza Bennett, it comes naturally. All dance is performance and presentation, I tell them. But do you see how different dances invite different interpretations? Oh, yes, says Nasreen. Compare this to the Persian dance. If those British could quiver their bodies the way we do, next to us, they're so chaste. I ask, who can dance Persian style? Everyone looks at Sanaz. She's shy and refuses to dance. We start to tease her and goad her on and form a circle around her. As she begins to move, self-consciously at first, we start to clap and murmur a song. Nasreen cautions us to be quieter. Sanaz begins shyly, taking graceful little steps, moving her waist with a lusty grace. As we laugh and joke more, she becomes bolder. She starts to move her head from side to side, and every part of her body asserts itself, vying for attention with the other parts. Her body quivers as she takes her small steps and dances with her fingers and her hands. A special look has appeared on her face. It is daring and beckoning, designed to attract, to pull in. But at the same time, it retracts and refracts with a power she loses as soon as she stops dancing. There are different forms of seduction, and the kind I have witnessed in Persian dancers is so unique, such a mixture of subtlety and brazenness, I cannot find a Western equivalent to compare it to. I have seen women of vastly different backgrounds take on that same expression, a hazy, lazy, flirtatious look in their eyes. I found Sanaz's look years later in the face of my sophisticated, French-educated friend Leili, as she suddenly began to dance to music that was filled with stretches of naz and eshve and kereshme, all words whose substitutes in English, coquettishness, teasing, flirtatiousness, seem not just poor, but irrelevant. This sort of seduction is elusive. It is sinewy and tactile. It twists, twirls, winds and unwinds. Hands curl and uncurl while the waist seems to coil and recoil. It is calculated. It predicts its effect before another little step is taken, and then another little step. It is flirtations in a way Miss Daisy Miller and her likes could never dream of being. It is openly seductive, but not surrendering. All this is there in Sanaz's dance. Her large black robe and black headscarf framing her bony face, her large eyes and very slim and fragile body, oddly enough, add to the allure of the movements. With each move, she seems to free herself from her layers of black cloth. The robe becomes diaphanous. Its texture adds to the mystery of her dance. We were surprised by a startled student who opened the door. The lunch hour was over. We had not noticed the time. Looking at the student standing on the threshold with one foot in the classroom, we started to laugh. That meeting created a secret pact among us. We talked about creating a clandestine group and calling it the Dear Jane Society. We would meet and dance and eat cream puffs, and we would share the news. Although we never formed any such secret society, the girls referred to themselves from then on as Dear Janes, and it planted the seed for our present complicity. I would have forgotten all about it had I not recently started to think about Nasreen. I now remember that it was that day, as Mahshid, Nasreen and I walked to my office, that quite suddenly, without thinking of it, I asked them to join my secret class. Looking at their astonished faces, I quickly sketched out the concept, improvising perhaps on what I had dreamed of and planned for so many years in my mind. "What will be required of us?" Mahshid asked. "Absolute commitment to the works, to the class," I said, with an impetuous air of finality. More than committing them, I had now committed myself. 3. I'm too much of an academic. I've written too many papers and articles to be able to turn my experiences and ideas into narratives without pontificating. Although that is in fact my urge, to narrate, to reinvent myself along with all those others. As I write, the road is clear, the Tin Man recovers his heart, and the Lion his courage. But this is not my story. I walk down a different road, whose end I cannot foresee. I know as little about where this road leads as Alice knew when she first ran after the white rabbit, the one who was wearing a waistcoat and a watch, and muttering, "I'm late, I'm late." I could not find a better way of explaining the overall structure of Pride and Prejudice to my classes than to compare it to the 18th century dance, the kind one imagines Darcy and Elizabeth performed in one of the numerous balls they attended. Although balls and dances are instruments of plot in some of Austen's other novels, in Mansfield Park, for example, and Emma, in no other novel does dance play such a focal role. It is not the specific number of dances that I'm concerned with here. As I said, the whole structure of the novel is like a dance, which is both a public and a private act. The atmosphere in Pride and Prejudice does carry the festive air of a ball. So the structure is that of dance and digression. It moves in parallels, contrapuntally, in terms not only of events and characters, but also settings. First, we see Elizabeth in her setting. Then, we see her out of her setting and in Darcy's. Then, we see Darcy in his true setting. Each of these shifts in perspective brings them closer. Darcy's proposal to Elizabeth runs parallel to Collins's proposal. There are also parallels between the characters of Darcy and Wickham. Like a camera, Darcy's view of Elizabeth pans in to a close-up. In the second part of the novel, the reverse happens as Elizabeth moves closer to Darcy. All the main actors are introduced at the first dance, and the conflict sparked there is the tension that will carry us through the novel. Elizabeth becomes Darcy's enemy at that first dance, when she overhears him tell Bingley she's not handsome enough to dance with. Later, he meets her at the next ball. He has begun to change his mind, but she refuses his offer to dance. At Netherfield, they meet again, and this time they dance, a dance that, despite its civilized appearance, is charged with tension. His attraction to her increases in direct ratio to her repulsion. The discordant notes in their dialogue contradict the smooth movements of their bodies on the dance floor. Austin's protagonists are private individuals set in public places. Their desire for privacy and reflection is continually being adjusted to their situation within a very small community, which keeps them under its constant scrutiny. The balance between the public and the private is essential to this world. The backwards and forward rhythm of the dance is repeated in the actions and movements of the two protagonists around whom the plot is shaped. Parallel events bring them closer together and then thrust them apart. Throughout the novel, Elizabeth and Darcy constantly move towards and away from each other. Each time they move forward, the ground is prepared for the next move. Moving backwards is accompanied by a reappraisal of the former forward move. There is a give and take in the dance, a constant adapting to the partner's needs and steps. Note, for example, how terrible Mr. Collins is on the dance floor, as is the uncouth Thorpe in Northanger Abbey. Their inability to dance well is a sign of their inability to adapt themselves to the needs of their partners. The centrality of dialogue in Pride and Prejudice fits well into the dance-like structure of the novel. It seems that in almost every scene, there is an ongoing dialogue between Elizabeth and Darcy. This dialogue is either real or imagined, but it is a constant preoccupation, leading from exchanges with the other to exchanges with the self. This central dialogue between Elizabeth and Darcy and Elizabeth and herself is accompanied by a multiplicity of other conversations. One of the most wonderful things about Pride and Prejudice is the variety of voices it embodies. There are so many different forms of dialogue between several people, between two people, internal dialogue, and dialogue through letters. All tensions are created and resolved through dialogue. Austin's ability to create such multivocality, such diverse voices and intonations in relation and in confrontation within a cohesive structure is one of the best examples of the democratic aspect of the novel. In Austin's novels, there are spaces for oppositions that do not need to eliminate each other in order to exist. There is also space. Not just space, but a necessity for self-reflection and self-criticism. Such reflection is the cause of change. We needed no message, no outright call for plurality to prove our point. All we needed was to read and appreciate the cacophony of voices to understand its democratic imperative. This was where Austin's danger lay. It is not accidental that the most unsympathetic characters in Austin's novels are those who are incapable of genuine dialogue with others. They rant, they lecture, they scold. This incapacity for true dialogue implies an incapacity for tolerance, self-reflection, and empathy. Later in Nabokov, this incapacity takes on monstrous forms in characters such as Humbert Humbert in Lolita and Kinboat in Pale Fire. Pride and Prejudice is not poetic, but it has its own cacophonies and harmonies. Voices approach and depart and take a turn around the room. Right now, as I flip through the pages, I can hear them leaping out. I catch Mary's pathetic dry voice and Kitty's cough and Miss Bingley's chaste insinuations. And here I catch a word by the courtly Sir Lucas. I can't quite hear Miss Darcy, shy and reserved as she is, but I hear steps going up and down the stairs, and Elizabeth's light mockery and Darcy's reserved tender tone. And as I close the book, I hear the ironic tone of the narrator. And even with the book closed, the voices don't stop. There are echoes and reverberations that seem to leap off the pages and mischievously leave the novel tingling in our ears. 4. Arsanaz has so many qualifications, Azin was saying as she meticulously inspected her fingernails. She doesn't need a two-bit boy whose greatest accomplishment has been to dodge the draft and move to England. Her tone was needlessly ferocious, and at the moment she was targeting no one in particular. This was when I began to pay serious attention to Azin's nails. She had taken to polishing them a bright tomato red and appeared totally preoccupied by their shape and color. Throughout class, whenever she found the opportunity, she would scrutinize her nails as if the red varnish connected her to a different dimension, a place known only to Azin. When she stretched her hand to take a pastry or an orange, her eyes attentively followed the movement of her red-tipped fingers. We were discussing Sanaz during the break. She was due back from Turkey the following week. Mitra, the only one who was in touch with her, updated us. He was very sweet. She loved him. They were engaged. They had gone together to the seaside. There will be pictures, lots of pictures. The aunt doesn't think he's such a catch. She thinks he's a nice boy, better as a boyfriend, needs someone to help him hold up his pants. Dimples widen. That didn't seem to bother Arsanaz. Nothing wrong with being young, Yossi chirped in. That's how my uncle and his wife started, and on top of that, they had no money. Actually, come to think of it, three of my uncles married that way. All but the youngest, who never married. He joined a political organization, she added, as if that explained why he had never married. We were hearing about the uncles more often now, because the eldest was in Iran for a three-week vacation. He was Yossi's favorite. He listened to her poetry, looked over her sister Mina's paintings, commented on their shy mother's stories. He was patient, attentive, encouraging, and at the same time, a bit critical, pointing out this little flaw, that weakness. Yossi was elated whenever he came for visits, or on the rare occasions he wrote home or called from the States and asked specifically to talk to her. He was the only one who was allowed to put ideas into Yossi's head without any reproach. And he did put ideas into her head. First, he encouraged her to continue her musical practices. Then he had said, why not go to the university in Tehran? Now, he advised her to continue her studies in America. Everything he told Yossi about life in America, events that seemed routine to him, gained a magical glow in her greedy eyes. She regularly checked these stories with me, and I always had something of my own to add. I felt as if her uncle and I were co-conspirators, leading young Yossi astray. And I worried, what if we were encouraging her into a life that was essentially not good for her? I could see how our encouragements also made Yasi, an affectionate and loyal girl, very much attached to her affectionate family, feel conflicted and depressed for days on end. She'd make fun of herself and say that she constantly feels indecisive, I'd ask. No, what's the word? Suddenly, her face would light up. Cantankerous. No, Yasi, that's not it. Definitely not cantankerous. Yes, well, indecisive as well as inadequate. That I do feel. Maybe I also feel cantankerous. Nowadays, all my girls seemed to want to leave Iran. All except Mahshid, who was more than ever preoccupied by her job. She wanted a promotion and permanence, which she was denied on the basis of her past political affiliation with a religious opposition group. Mitra had already applied for a visa to Canada, although she and Hamid had their doubts. His mother was against it. And then there was the prospect of an unknown future in Canada, while this life, despite its flaws, was a known quantity. Hamid had a good job. They were secure. Over here, as his mother keeps reminding us, we are somebody. But over there? I'm thinking of going, Azin said suddenly. If Sanaz had an inkling of sense, she'd just go, or marry the guy, go there, and then divorce him. What? She asked defensively, confronted by the other's startled look, nervously fishing a cigarette out of her bag. What did I say now? She did not light the cigarette. She never did during class sessions, but she held it between her long white fingers with their tomato-red nails. Suddenly she noticed our silence, and like a child caught stealing a chocolate, she looked at her unlit cigarette and crushed it in the ashtray with a disarming smile. How do you get away with those nails? I asked her to change the subject. I wear gloves, she said. Even in summer, I wear dark gloves. Polished nails, like makeup, were a punishable offense, resulting in flogging, fines, and up to 1 year imprisonment. Of course, they know the trick, she said, and if they really want to bug you, they'll tell you to take off the gloves. She babbled on, talking about gloves and fingernails, and then she came to a sudden halt. It makes me happy, she said in a thin voice that did not suggest any trace of happiness. It's so red. It takes my mind off things. Off what things? Nasreen asked, gently for once. Oh, things, you know. And then she burst into tears. We were startled into silence, Mana grudgingly, with an obvious attempt to resist Azin's tears, passed her the box of tissues. Mahshid recoiled into her shell, and Nasreen leaned forward, her hands locked together in a ferocious grip. Yasi, who sat closest to Azin, leaned towards her, gently pressing her right shoulder. 5. I will never now discover the real wounds Azin hid and the unreal ones she revealed. I look for some answer in the photograph we took on my last night in Tehran, my eyes diverted by a glint in Azin's round gold earrings. Photographs can be deceptive unless, like my magician, one has the gift of discovering something from the curve of a person's nose. I do not possess such gifts. As I look at that photograph, none of Azin's troubles can be imagined. She looks carefree. Her blonde hair suits her pale skin and dark honey eyes. She loved to seem outrageous, and the fact that she had been married 3 times supported her claims to this title. She had married her first husband before she'd turned 18 and had divorced him within a year. She never explained what had happened with her second husband. Perhaps she married so often because marriage was easier in Iran than having a boyfriend. Her husband, she told us, seemed to be frustrated by all that interested her. He was jealous of her books, her computer, and her Thursday mornings. With a fixed smile, she related how he felt humiliated by what she called her independent spirit. He beat her up and then tried to placate her by swearing his undying love. I was almost physically hurt by her account. More than the beatings, it was his taunts that disturbed me. How he shouted that no one would marry her, that she was used like a second-hand car, that no man would want to have a second-hand wife. He would tell her that he could marry an 18-year-old girl. He could marry a fresh, first-hand 18-year-old any old time. He would tell her all this, and yet he could not leave her. I remember not so much her words, but how, as she continued her terrible story, her smile was belied by the shine of tears. After she told us her story, she said, "And now you know why I am so often late for class." Later, Mona would say without much sympathy, "Trust Azin to try to get something cheap, even out of her own troubles." Soon we were all involved in Azin's marital problems. First, I recounted them to Bijan after dinner, and then I talked to my best friend, a great lawyer with a weakness for lost causes, and convinced her to accept her case. From then on, Azin, her vacillations, her husband, her complaints, her sincerity or lack of it, became a constant topic of our discussions. These forays into the personal were not supposed to be part of the class, but they infiltrated our discussions, bringing with them further incursions. Starting with abstractions, we wandered into the realm of our own experiences. We talked about different instances in which the physical and mental abuse of women had been considered insufficient grounds for divorce by the ruling judge. We discussed cases in which the judge not only refused the wife's request for divorce, but tried to blame her for her husband's beatings, ordering her to reflect on the wrongs she had committed to bring on his displeasure. We joked about the judge who used to regularly beat his own wife. In our case, the law really was blind. In its mistreatment of women, it knew no religion, race, or creed.